From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Some North Carolina lawmakers want to take a closer look at an opportunity gap in the state's public schools. You'll hear the proposal and reaction from the John Locke Foundation's education expert. A bill dubbed Sam's Law aims to help students who suffer seizures in school. You'll learn details. Controversy surrounds a proposal dubbed the First Step Act. You'll learn why lawmakers are giving mixed reviews to a plan that would give judges more discretion in drug trafficking cases. And you'll hear more about efforts to clean up North Carolina's complicated, confusing criminal code. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Governor Roy Cooper wants to take on debt to build new schools in our state. The General Assembly, however, prefers the pay-as-you-go model, and the dispute has been front and center as our state's leaders sought to agree on a new state budget. Joe Coletti has taken a close look at the two different approaches to paying for schools, and he joins us now to share the analysis. Joe, of course, is senior fellow for the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Let's talk about the governor's philosophy first. He wants a bond. Tell us what that would entail. Why does he support that approach?
Yeah, well, actually, he's changed a little bit. The first time around, he wanted a $3.9 billion bond and to eliminate the state capital and infrastructure fund, which I know we'll get into, but which was the pay-as-you-go approach that you mentioned that the legislature wants. So that was his first attempt, was just all borrow, no capital funding outside of the state budget for schools. His counteroffer was to have a bond and to take some money from this and then to keep the SCIF, the pay as you go fund. And so that's apparently a version of a compromise. The idea of it is that he wants to borrow money because he wants to use the money that would otherwise pay for capital projects. He wants to use that today, and he's perfectly okay taking on debt now and taking on obligations for spending now, and then having both the bond payments and the continuing spending from what he's obligated today continue on into the future and raise taxes if the need arises, which is the opposite of what the legislature is looking to do.
So he wants to spend money that we have now that's available to either return to taxpayers or to spend on programs. He wants to spend that on things, but then he wants to borrow money in order to build schools, which if you borrow, then that comes with payments and interest.
Yeah, that's future payments that he's committing us to. The estimates are about $1 billion more interest payments over the course of the payback period, on top of the $3.5 billion of borrowing that he wants to do between public schools, community colleges, the university, and local water projects. And some of that money is potentially one-time money that he's looking to spend, because the money is coming both from what would go into that pay-as-you-go fund, and some repair and renovation money, which comes. So the one part of it is just continuing revenue. The other part is the unreserved cash balance from last year. So money that we had left over, like a bonus payment. That wasn't spent last year. So that's pretty much one-time money. And the rest of it is continuing revenues. And so that's where the tricky part comes in, is that he's willing to also spend one-time money on current programs that will continue onward.
Let's talk then about the other approach, the one that the leadership in the General Assembly has taken, and they refer to it as the pay-as-you-go model. Yeah. Tell us how that works.
That one is it's through a state capital and infrastructure fund, which takes 4% of revenue for the year and a quarter of that unreserved cash balance, the leftover money from last year. and puts all of that into a pot that will then pay existing debt service. So money that we still owe on debts that we've taken out in the past, and put also some money into capital projects, whether that's repairs, renovations, or new construction. And they've pledged through that over the next 10 years to spend $1.5, $1.9 billion on schools.
It sounds, Joe, like if we picture this as with our own family budget, yeah, you've got basically a choice. You've got a certain amount of money that's sitting in your checking account, and the choice that we face as a state would be similar to what you face as a family. What do we want to do with this money? Do
right.
we want to spend it on what we consider a priority need, in this case, building schools, or do we want to spend it on something else, maybe right. a car payment or some other repair, and then go borrow the money
right.
to build the school? And
yeah,
that seems to be the fundamental question. How do you want to finance this? There's apparently no disagreement on the need for schools, right?
There is not. Once you at this point, we've questioned the need for that, because the estimates that they're using to justify the borrowing or the spending on schools is about 3 years old and doesn't take into account the bond issuance that local school districts have done, including $1 billion in Wake County. And it also doesn't take into account the fact that public school enrollment has been flat and falling through the state because people are opting for charter schools, for homeschools, and for other options outside of the districts. So we're starting from the point of, and once we get to the how do you pay for schools, that assumes that we're going to pay for schools, and so that argument isn't really at play anymore. But
you know, Joe, it should be at play, because, and I know you believe it should be at play, because that's a really crucial point. If you have parents who are opting for other venues, other education options other than a traditional public school classroom, I mean, how do we know into the future? Let's say we were going to borrow money in order to build schools. How would we know what level of need for additional traditional classroom seats there would be in all these different counties? How would we know?
That's another great argument for the pay-as-you-go option, which is that we don't. And when the estimates were made in 2016, Wake County was looking at, we're going to have another 35,000 students by 2025. And so they said, well, we'll have 185,000 students in 2025. And now that Wake County is estimating that out into 2027, so 2 years later, and the State Department of Public Instruction is saying that we're never going to get there, that we're pretty much at the peak enrollment in Wake County at about 160,000 students, well below that. And so that calls into question a lot of the need for the construction. And if you're calling into question the need for construction, the repairs and renovations in some of the smaller school districts, probably not an issue. But if that's what if you're not sure about what the future holds, as you asked, then there is really no reason to commit to borrowing money to pay for that. Obviously, you can hold back on taking out the bonds in the future and just let them leave them unissued. But it's much easier to just go with the state capital and infrastructure fund, the pay-as-you-go option, and say, we don't need this. We're not going to spend it. We're going to put it into something else that we need.
Pretty fascinating, particularly, as you know, our colleague, Dr. Terry Stoops, who analyzes education policy for the John Locke Foundation, has written recently about the surge in homeschooling
yes.
in North Carolina. Obviously, no seat needed for
right.
a student if they are homeschooled. And if that trend continues, that could have an impact on this whole discussion as well. Joe, when you're writing on the comparison between the bond route, the borrowing route, mm-hmm. versus the pay-as-you-go route, you ultimately conclude that if you go with the pay-as-you-go, use the money that we have right now, that we can build schools faster. How so?
Yeah. Well, this money becomes available sooner, and because a bond won't be voted on until November of next year, and then it has to be approved by the voters, and then you have to go through the Council of State and the Treasurer before you can even start issuing those bonds. And so that leaves about a 2 to 3 year gap between today and the time that the first money can be spent from a bond. And so that's about $500 million that can be spent immediately once the plans are in place. And so once school districts have what they want to build, you can start doing that well before the money is available from a bond.
You also say that pay-as-you-go ends up being cheaper, no interest to pay back,
no interest,
you would on debt, and you would have better financial controls as well. Joe Coletti is Senior Fellow with the John Locke Foundation. Joe, fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina policymakers continue to worry about an opportunity gap. What they mean is the apparent gap in public school student performance based on race or socioeconomic status. A bill moving through the General Assembly would set up a new group to study that gap. Republican Representative Hugh Blackwell of Burke County explains.
Many years ago in my youth, I served 8 years on the school board at home. And I remember even those years ago, us talking about what we referred to then as the achievement gap. Years later, I came to the legislature. We're still talking about the achievement gap. I've been here for a while. We're still talking about it.
So Blackwell came up with the idea of a new opportunity gap task force.
The idea behind this legislation is to try to come up with a plan that is specifically targeted at identifying what does and doesn't work by looking at what has worked elsewhere to work on this problem.
Blackwell says the task force will look into some of the basics of public education in North Carolina.
Most of us have heard over the years that our school calendar is related to our agrarian past. I think it's also fair to say that the school schedule in terms of the way it's organized in the classroom, is related to early 20th century manufacturing techniques where you move people through systematically. You're 8 years old, we put you in the third grade for a specified number of days, and then you move on, whether you've mastered what you need to be prepared to take advantage of the education offered you in the fourth grade. So our approach here is to try to get a broad group of individuals together as a task force. In addition to that, we recognize that there are other frequently referred to as stakeholders and groups in the state that we have asked that they be sure to listen to in the process of developing proposals. We've suggested some things in particular, such as best practices in public education, professional development, technology, and ask them to come up with this report to us.
The idea for an opportunity gap task force has bipartisan support. Democratic Representative Cecil Brockman of Guilford County is a primary sponsor of the task force bill.
We all know there are students in our public schools, for whatever reason, that are not as successful as they need to be. And I believe this bill is going to be a great to lead us to making sure all of our students are successful.
Brockman offers some sobering statistics.
In our rural districts, we have 62% of our students who are on free and reduced lunch. And in our urban communities, it's 46%. And we all know how much poverty plays a role into a student's success. And right now, in our public schools, 40% of African-American students are on grade level or are proficient. And in our counties, or in total of all our counties, 58% of our students from grades 3 through 8 are proficient in grade and tier 3. 62% of our students are proficient in tier 2. 59% of our students are proficient in our tier 1 counties. Only 51% of our students are successful. And so that, I think, really speaks to why we really need this.
Democratic Representative Charles Graham of Robeson County offered a word of caution to his colleagues.
I'm going to support this, but I want to touch base on the underlying issue, and I think Representative Brockman may have touched on that just momentarily, and that is poverty in our rural eastern North Carolina communities. Until we address that issue and do it with urgency and due diligence, a committee like this will not produce the kind of results that I think we're looking for. We have to address poverty first and foremost.
Brockman responded.
I completely agree with you, Representative Graham, but I would also like to give you some other statistics, another statistic that I actually just found out about. We've got 1,500 tier one counties, or excuse me, title one schools, and over 900 of those schools have C and above. So I believe the stereotype that just because they're a title one school that they're not going to be successful is wrong. So just because it's we do have issues of poverty, that doesn't mean that our students cannot be successful.
I happen to live in one of those rural counties. 30-40 public schools. Poverty is pervasive across that county, and I know we've had these task force meetings before. I participated in those task force meetings for 30 plus years, and we're talking about forming another task force to look at the same issue. I've been there and I've done that. And the issue, underlying issue, is poverty.
Representative Hugh Blackwell challenged the notion that poverty is destiny for North Carolina public school students.
I think partly what we are expecting is that research seems to support the idea that because a child comes out of poverty, it does not mean that they cannot be taught successfully. And this is about serving those students and any other students who are currently not having the opportunity, whether the opportunity gap is created by poverty or by a home situation, by the availability of resources, whatever it is. And our hope is that this is going to be sort of a comprehensive thing. We've been talking about it, as you say, for many years. This is one more effort, but maybe this time we'll get it right.
Dr. Terry Stoops, the Vice President for Research and Director of Education Studies at the John Locke Foundation, what do you think? Does it make sense to have another look at this opportunity gap?
Absolutely. When you look at the achievement gaps in North Carolina, they remain rather large. Barely half of North Carolina students are proficient in reading and math. But when you start breaking it down into the various ethnic and racial subgroups, you find that 4 in 10 of those students are usually proficient in reading and math. So I think it really makes sense for us to begin looking at what factors are involved in perpetuating this gap, and then what kind of intervention schools can incorporate into their instruction to address it.
One of the criticisms that we heard during the committee meeting was, it's all just poverty. It all comes down to poverty. If we address poverty, we will solve this problem. There was some pushback saying, no, there are ways to help kids who are in poverty. What do you think?
Well, we look at some schools that are successful raising student achievement with kids in poverty. These are usually charter schools in low-income areas. We've had success with the KIPP chain of charter schools. It's been very successful at raising student achievement for low-income students. So we have models out there that show us the way. And I would say that those who are arguing that it's just poverty need to be careful, because if poverty really is the problem, then we're wasting a lot of money throwing it at the education system. We should be throwing it at social programs that address the poverty issue.
Is there one particular thing you're hoping to see out of this group?
Well, I'm hoping that we start to see individuals focusing on the student achievement in reading and math, those gaps, and those measures that can really make a difference. This is things like direct instruction. This is things like getting back to math instruction using standard algorithms. These are very basic, time-tested principles that allow us to help those that are struggling achieve what they should be achieving in math and reading.
We're talking about a proposed Opportunity Gap Task Force. It would need support from both the House and Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's enough to scare any parent. A student has a seizure at school and no one knows what to do. That's the scenario that prompted Sam's Law. Republican Representative Steve Jarvis explains.
What this does is actually gives the teachers, it gives the school direction. Each school system can create their policies in order to create training, which can be video training. I think they're online through the association for the different employees. And then they can have an action plan set in place for those that do have seizures that they know about. The reason for the instruction to all of the employees or volunteers is because sometimes some students may not have epilepsy, but may end up having a seizure in their classroom. And I've spoken to several teachers that have been in that situation, and they said that it was a very scary thing, and they didn't know what to do. So that's sort of the origination of where it came from. And due to the fact that we do have 15,200 students in our school systems today that are known to have epilepsy, that's the reason I bring the bill before you.
Democrat Greg Meyer supported the idea with one request.
I think that seizure disorders are worth paying attention to. I have one request for you in moving the bill forward. The seizure action plan that is requested. Schools already have something called an individual health plan that is a format to use to be able to address individual health needs. I would just ask that you work with the Department of Public Instruction to make sure that this doesn't create a duplicate process to that, and that the individual health plans could be qualified to meet the standards that you're setting up.
Jarvis raised no objection. He also answered a question about costs.
All of the training and all of the documentation for posters are online on the Epilepsy Foundation and available for free.
Legislative staffer Drupti Chauhan addressed concerns about liability.
There's a limitation on liability that covers everybody, including employees, volunteers, agents, members of the school, governing body, whoever. That is standard language that we have in other statutes that are similar, where school personnel or volunteers or somebody else is maybe having to administer asthma medication. So that's sort of a limitation on liability for somebody who has the authority to do something, but then for whatever reason, if there's a mistake, then that they are not held liable for that.
You've been listening to discussion of Sam's Law. It calls for school plans to help students at risk for an epileptic seizure. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers are pushing a measure dubbed the North Carolina First Step Act. It deals with criminal punishment for drug offenders. It generated plenty of debate in a recent committee meeting. Republican Representative Holly Grange made the case for the measure.
It is modeled almost word for word after a provision in the Federal First Step Act that was signed into law in December 2018. And what the bill does, it allows a sentencing court to deviate from the minimum and maximum sentences, the mandated sentences for drug trafficking offenses. It also allows a person who is sentenced solely for trafficking or conspiracy to commit trafficking, it allows them to file a motion for appropriate relief to have their sentence modified. And it also authorizes the Department of Information Technology and the Administrative Office of the Courts to study the collection of criminal justice data.
Senator Bob Steinberg supports the bill. He places it in a larger context.
This is another ongoing effort on the part of those of us in the General Assembly to try and take a hard look at our judicial system, our Department of Corrections, our sentencing, and move things into the 21st century and really consider something that is not very often considered in these matters, and that is mercy. One of the things that I have found in talking with literally hundreds of people about this particular issue are the lives that have been really destroyed simply because of a forced sentencing aspect where all of the considerations that a judge might have previously been able to take into consideration before applying a sentence, these mandatory sentencing guidelines now have made that impossible and have taken all the discretion away from the judge.
Grange and Steinberg are both Republicans, but they faced some criticism from GOP colleagues. Senate Majority Leader Harry Brown spelled out his concerns.
I really think there's going to be some unintended consequences with this. You know, I ran a bill, death by distribution, and this seems to be going in the other direction, in my opinion. You're talking about drug trafficking offenses here. With structured sentencing, what I see was some consistency by the judges on what you impose, on what penalties are imposed. This bill, it's my understanding some of these aren't under structured sentencing, but I think you'll see a wide variety of sentencings across the state depending on the judge under this act. And I just think that just creates problems down the road, and I'm just struggling with this bill, to be quite honest with you, for that very reason.
Senator Chuck Edwards raised his own objections to the bill.
I sense a real disparity in the philosophy of the General Assembly. It seems to me like we've done an awful lot over the last couple of years, including this session, to strengthen drug laws and to say that we're serious in North Carolina in holding accountable and punishing those folks that are out there selling this poison and contributing so ferociously towards the problem that we have today. And I sense that this is just a real softening on that position and in direct conflict to so many of the other things that we've been trying to do here. I'm having a hard time supporting this as well.
Edwards' comments prompted a response from fellow Republican Bob Steinberg.
This particular bill is not a bill that is going soft on crime. This is not a bill that is lessening the punishment for drug pushers and folks that are out on the street selling drugs. That is not what this bill is all about. This bill is basically about folks who are caught up in some level of this. But I think the bill points out very clearly that this is not for the big dogs that are out there pushing narcotics and so on and so forth. A lot of these folks are one-time people who may have been caught up with this thing, and there's other information that comes to light. Nobody wants to be soft on crime. I certainly don't want to be soft on crime either. But like everything else, there are two sides to everything. Why would the federal government be embracing this? And they have indeed embraced this. If this were going soft on crime, I don't think our president is soft on crime, and he is the biggest advocate for this First Step Act. So I think we need to keep that in mind, and those folks who are continuing to push these drugs and sell these drugs, I'm for, you know, throwing them in jail and throwing the key away. But that's not where we are. That's not who this bill is trying to address.
Steinberg's words didn't convince his Republican Senate colleague Chuck Edwards.
Because the federal government is doing it is probably one of the worst arguments that I've ever heard. I think we have to do what's right for North Carolina. And I, for one, would like to make the statement that these behaviors are behaviors that are just not tolerable, and if they're detected, then they are punishable. And regardless of how you want to position it, I believe it, yes, it is being soft on crime. And I believe it's up to the General Assembly to decide, as it has been for hundreds of years, what the punishment should be for various crimes, instead of allowing a judge to make exceptions to those. So, again, I appreciate your position. You haven't changed my mind.
It's easy to stake out a position and say, this is where we are, without making any exceptions at all. And I don't think that's very realistic in the judicial system, and that's one of the reasons why we have judges, for judges to take a look at what is going on, what are the particulars of the situation, and then giving that judge the latitude to be able to adjust a sentence according to the information he has, and not be forced into a maximum and disregarding absolutely everything else that he knows to be true.
Another Republican senator, Ralph Hise, shared with colleagues a recent conversation he had with his longest-serving local sheriff.
His job's to protect the community. And he would talk about spending years to build a case. And these are, quite frankly, trafficking cases. These are for those who are having a mount beyond personal use. This is for individuals who are selling or trafficking in narcotics. And to get to that level that they have a certainty that this charge can get someone off the street for a certain number of years, because, quite frankly, the scourge they are to the community. But to be able now to have any judge that's out there be able to change that once the individual's convicted, I think that's a huge problem for our communities. And I think it's a huge problem to kind of send that message out there that, you know, we're going to give that kind of forgiveness to particular judges, and justice becomes the luck of the draw for the judge that you happen to get today. And we've seen enough of that in North Carolina on all kinds of issues, where a particular judge which will take these opportunities that another would not.
You've been listening to Debate about the North Carolina First Step Act. It targets criminal sentences linked to drug trafficking. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. What constitutes a crime in North Carolina isn't really as obvious as you'd think. So how can that be? Our next guest links the confusion to an antiquated and ineffective criminal code that's spread across 100 chapters of the North Carolina General Statutes. In a recent piece published in the North State Journal, Mike Sheetzelt, who is the John Locke Foundation's legal fellow, focused on two examples that illustrate the point that we've got a lot of work to do in this regard. Mike, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
First, explain to us, what is the criminal code when we say that?
So when, at least when I'm writing about the criminal code, and I think the way most people understand the criminal code is, what is a crime in North Carolina? What allows the criminal justice system to punish you for violating one of these laws, for engaging in prescribed behavior, that proscribed behavior, the banned behavior.
You're not just talking about breaking and entering or violent crime. You're talking
right.
about anything in state law or state code that says that you could be held legally accountable for doing something that the state has said is illegal.
Absolutely. And there's a handful of sources of that. We all think of Chapter 14 and the criminal chapter of the general statutes. But as you mentioned, there's well over 100 chapters of the general statutes that contain crimes within them. You have agency rules that are passed by various departments in the executive branch that are criminalized by more general statutes. Then you have ordinances, local ordinances, that are made criminal by default unless the local body makes them not criminal. And you have some crimes, like some of the ones you mentioned, that are defined by the common law, which means judicial opinions. They're not defined by statute or by ordinance or anything. They're not written down except in judicial opinions.
This, is, I think, is pretty fascinating because you are an attorney. I am not an attorney. And I'm thinking, when I hear the word crime, obviously in a civil, peaceful society, you know that to go knock someone over the head with a baseball bat would be a crime.
Right.
You know that stealing someone's car would be a crime. But how is someone like me supposed to know what is a crime if it's not in the area of a violent offense?
That's one of the problems we're working on. What constitutes proper notice of what is criminal behavior? And a lot of times there's really no way to know. It would be an all-consuming task to try and find out what's criminal in your area. And we've seen, particularly in our study of local ordinances, that there are just some crazy things out there that can be punished with a class 3 misdemeanor. For not having a screen on a window in your house that you use to open and close. That could be...
That's crazy.
That's crazy. Having a stale bird bath out in the yard that is a breeding ground for mosquitoes, or an old tire that's laying out there. Having grass that grows too tall, and whether that's 10 or 12 inches in some localities or 24 inches in other localities. Having too many dogs on your property. There are a lot of things that are criminalized, and it's different from county to county, from town to town. You have more than 600 counties and municipalities added up together, and they have more than 600 opinions on what should be criminal.
This is why you're focusing on this here
Absolutely.
At the John Locke Foundation, because not only are they antiquated, in some cases crazy, but they're different all over the place. So there's really all this collection from over years and years and years, and you have been trying to get policymakers to kind of focus on this and say, we can make this better. We can make it more understandable. We can maybe cut out some of the things that we can now decide don't really need to be a crime and things like that. You wrote a really fascinating piece published in North State Journal, and you gave us a couple of examples of how this can be unfair to people in very interesting ways. Talk to us a little bit about what happened in Greensboro with the woman who was charged with felony littering.
Right. So that's a very interesting case, because here you had clear wrongdoing that went unpunished. There was a woman who had found a scrap metal tank, and the scrap metal tank had some sort of liquid in it that made it hard to move. So she dumped it out, not realizing that it was heating oil. So to try and avoid some of the technicalities, which she challenged when she went to trial on this, she was charged with felony littering for dumping heating oil and costing Guilford County more than $10,000 to clean it up. She tried to argue, I didn't know that this was heating oil, and therefore I didn't have what we call mens rea, the guilty mindset, that should be required under the statute. The court didn't buy that argument, so she took a different line of attack at the Court of Appeals. There's a technicality in North Carolina law that allows you to challenge your indictment at any point. The indictment is the ticket that the prosecutor has to have to get you into court. It gives the court power over you. And so you can challenge it at any point. And she challenged it on appeal and wound up winning on appeal, saying, well, they left out an element that had no bearing on her case at all. So in this instance, an ambiguity in the law allowed her to challenge it at court. She lost there, challenged a different technicality ambiguous technicality in the law on appeal. And wound up getting a second bite at the apple to go back and have another trial and drag this process out. That's not fair, and it's not appropriately treating wrongdoers when we allow them to take advantage of these loopholes in the law. So that's that case and essentially how that wound up working its way through
the
court.
So one of your efforts then, when you talk about trying to urge policymakers to review all of these things and to say, do we need this or do we not, is to eliminate all of that ambiguity so that it becomes very clear what the law is and you either break it or you don't.
Right. And it's impossible to remove every ambiguity. The language is always going to be ambiguous to some extent. You can't foresee every instance that's going to pop up. But to the extent possible, our criminal law needs to have bright lines so that people know, what can I do? What can't I do? that line needs to be apparent to everyone. And that's what we're talking about when we're talking about notice.
Now, you also write in your piece for North State Journal about the case, this one also out of Guilford County, where you had essentially a tap room that got in trouble, ran afoul of the law. They didn't really even know what was going on and had to do with allowing dogs inside?
Yes. So Joy Mongers is a very popular establishment in Greensboro. I've been there myself, and it's a great atmosphere where people can go in, have a beer, they bring their dogs. And they apparently didn't think that they were a food establishment under the health code because they didn't serve any food. But because of the way food establishment was defined, the Guilford County Health Department came in and said, you can't allow these dogs in. That's a class 3 or class 2 misdemeanor, whatever. I can't remember which. But they gave them basically a cease and desist order on the allowing the dogs in, and that created a huge public outcry.
So what happened in response to the public outcry?
Well, in response to the public outcry, they decided, well, we're just not going to push this right now, and we'll put everything on hold until maybe we can get a legislative fix. And I think that the biggest issue there is that's it undermines the rule of law. It undermines the rule of law when we say, okay, well, county officials, that, you know, this is the law, but we're just not going to prosecute it because it turns out this was crazy and maybe it shouldn't have been a crime to begin with. And so you allow the crimes to be defined by public opinion. And that doesn't seem to be the best way to go about punishing wrongdoers, is whether or not the public thinks they have committed some sort of a wrong.
And your point, also in a lot of your writings on this, is that it's up to the legislature, and not the public, but the legislature doing the work of the people who've elected them to take a look at this, to review this. And in fact, the legislature has kind of started into this process. Give us an update.
So right now, the legislature, they passed a bill last year that was seeking more information from cities and counties about what's a crime in their local jurisdictions. Not everybody responded. So they've pushed. Now, this session, they seem to be pushing towards getting more of that information in. And with that information, what we can do is we can push a recodification commission to rewrite the criminal laws and create those bright lines.
Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.